now we change gears as we turn to Michigan festivals. It's been enjoyable exploring the unique summer festivals that happened around our state, celebrating everything from baby food to bologna. This coming Saturday, you can head towards Muskegon for the first ever Great Lakes Surf Festival, which bills itself as a celebration of Great Lakes surf culture. Joe Bitterwood has been riding the Great Lakes for some 30 years. The festival is his idea. He's with us now. Joe, what gave you the idea to pull all this together into a festival?
A couple of years ago, discussing it with a few friends, we thought that it would be great to have an event that would bring everyone together, different board riding disciplines, and just really to have a celebration of Great Lakes surf culture.
So the idea is it's not a competition. It's not just a festival. It's, as you say, a celebration. And what kinds of board activities are we talking about, Joe?
Well, Cindy, we have over 40 activities going on Saturday, August 18th at Pier Marquette Beach. And we focus on entry-level lessons, so we will be teaching hundreds of people how to surf, paddleboard, and kayak. And we'll also have family-friendly events. So we've really focused on trying to make this an all-around event so that board heads can come and enjoy it, but also beachgoers that just want to have a great beach day can also come and participate and enjoy the event.
And when we talk about board heads and we talk about the kinds of fun that people can have on the water, so we're talking, as you mentioned, paddleboard, there's kiteboarding. I have a very good friend who lives to kiteboard, the surfer board that we know of from Beach Boys tunes. So we've got all kinds of activities, right?
That's correct. I mean, we really have a full day, and I think it'll be an amazing event because it'll be a scene out of, you know, somewhere you would see in Hawaii or California. You know, we have a great, great surf culture on the Great Lakes, and we're on the cusp of having the second generation of riders. You know, I consider myself a first generation Great Lakes waterman, and now we have the second generation. And so we also, part of the reason for this event is we wanted to empower that second generation to kind of showcase that history that we have. And so we're excited.
Tell me about riding the Great Lakes. How does it compare to, let's say, what we might have seen in Hawaii or off the coast of California?
Well, Cindy, when you think of surfing in Hawaii or California, your mind immediately goes to the image of a sun-kissed culture. On the Great Lakes, it's a little different. It's more elemental. There are times where we deal with harsh conditions. And the activity, I would say that it would be more victory at sea than, you know, the sun-kissed scene. But with that said, during the summer months, it's a very viable activity for someone who's getting into surfing, paddleboarding, or kayaking. And one of the amazing things we have now is we have some really great retail presence. So we have up and down the coast, we have great retailers that offer lessons and just make it really, really easy and conducive for people to get into these sports and learn the correct way and the safe way.
And people can enjoy these sports on the inland lakes as well.
Sure. I mean, that's amazing. We have so much water and so much access.
And I know you are a former professional windsurfer. You've been riding the Great Lakes for, some 30 years. Take us into the feeling, a perfect day on the water for you. How does that feel?
Well, the other nice thing about riding on the Great Lakes is oftentimes it's not crowded. And so the perfect day is sunny on a sandy beach and surrounded by friends. In my case, my wife and my kids love the beach and enjoy the beach. So that would make it a perfect day.
Well, for veterans or newbies, there it is all happening this Saturday, the first Great Lakes Surf Festival at Pier Marquette Beach near Muskegon. And you can get all the details at the website, greatlakessurffestival.com. Joe Bitterwood, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing your love of being on the water.
Cindy, we're so stoked to be on your show, and we hope that you and anyone listening would come and join us. It'll be a great time.
Thank you. It is the stuff of science fiction. Send a space mission to the sun. But science fiction became reality this week as NASA launched the Parker Solar Probe, humanity's first ever mission into the part of the sun's atmosphere known as the corona. In the words of NASA, to touch the sun. Justin Casper is a principal investigator for this historic mission and a climate space science professor at the University of Michigan. I asked him, just what is it about the sun they're hoping to learn?
Well, one of the most perplexing things about the sun that a lot of people might not know is the surface of the sun glows yellow because it's at around 6,000 degrees Celsius, which is pretty hot.
Yeah.
But if you go just a few hundred kilometers above the surface of the sun, the temperature actually rises. And the solar corona sits at around 1 to 2 million degrees. It's nearly 1,000 times hotter than the surface. And we'd really like to understand what physics is happening there that's able to heat an atmosphere to make it so much hotter than the surface.
Because it doesn't click with what we understand with our atmosphere.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, just think about like a campfire. You put your hand near the flame, it's hot. You move your hand away, things cool off. That's just fundamental thermodynamics. It's what we're used to. The further away you are from heat, the cooler things get. So something is able to take some form of energy, get it up into the atmosphere, and then dissipate it and heat it to these really high temperatures.
And I know that the solar probe is going to be helping us understand the solar wind.
Yes.
What is that?
That's right. In the 1950s, a professor, Eugene Parker, who the mission has now been named after, realized that it's actually totally unstable for a star to have a million-degree atmosphere. Given the mass of our sun, it can't actually hold that atmosphere in place. So the corona actually wants to lift off away from the sun. And then what happens is it actually feels a accelerating push as it expands outwards. So by the time it's a couple solar radii away from the sun, it's moving at faster than the speed of sound. And by the time it's maybe 10 solar radii away, it's moving at maybe a million miles an hour. Or hundreds of kilometers per second.
And when you say solar radii, what kind of distance are
we talking
about?
Yeah, let me put that in perspective.
Yeah.
So an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the sun. The Earth is about 215 solar radii away from the sun. I'm talking about things that are happening in the first 5 or 10% of the way from the sun to Earth.
Okay. So as that's happening and moving out, how does that affect us here on Earth?
Sure. So turns out once this wind is created, it's moving in jets in every direction away from the sun at extremely high speed. So what it does is it carves actually a bubble out of the local space in our galaxy. So our entire solar system and all the planets orbiting the sun are being bathed in this solar wind. And the solar wind is incredibly variable. There'll be very high-speed gusts that might be moving at a few million miles an hour, and then it slows down to just half a million miles an hour. And so imagine your Earth, you have a protective magnetic field that's shielding you from a lot of the radiation in space, but you're getting buffeted by these different streams. This is fundamentally what causes a lot of the aurora and northern lights, but can also disrupt GPS navigation, mm-hmm. radar, radio communication. We call all this phenomena, we now call it space weather. It's like weather in space. And it can have a huge effect on society.
And what might we learn about that through this probe?
There are two things. I'll just give you two examples of things we do really poorly. We do a really bad job telling whether or not one of these gusts of solar wind is going to hit Earth, if it'll be fast or slow. And then every now and then we have a very violent eruption on the solar surface called a coronal mass ejection. And that's when a big chunk of the corona actually gets hurled out at very high speeds. So we call those CMEs or coronal mass ejections. And just to try to put that in perspective, a coronal mass ejection might involve an amount of mass equivalent to all the water in Lake Michigan going from rest to moving at a few million miles an hour in just a few minutes. And so if one of those CMEs hits Earth, it can cause a huge disturbance. There was a very famous event more than 150 years ago we call the Carrington event. When it swept past Earth, it set telegraph lines on fire. The northern lights were seen all the way down to the Caribbean, and compasses just started wiggling around wildly. we worry that if an event like that were to happen today, it could potentially knock out all power distribution on the east and west coasts of the United States. We would potentially be without electricity for years. It's very hard to even calculate what impact that has on society.
So it's a very good thing to understand
this a bit
better.
It's a good thing to understand it. Exactly.
Tell us about this trip to the sun, this probe. How many miles and how long will it take for the probe to get there?
Yeah, so it turns out one of the reasons it took so long to do solar probe is it's actually really difficult to get close to the sun. And this might seem counterintuitive, but Earth is actually moving around the sun at a pretty good clip. So we have two problems with our spacecraft. First, we need to escape Earth's gravity. But once we get up into space, we actually have to slow down compared to Earth in order to fall towards the sun. So there were earlier ideas like we'll go out to Jupiter and we'll swing around Jupiter and it'll fling us towards the sun. We wound up coming up with a way that lets us get to the sun a lot closer. So we launched this week. We're currently now scrambling, checking out all the systems on the spacecraft, and it's headed straight towards Venus. And in just about 7 weeks or so, we're going to pass just a couple hundred kilometers over the surface of Venus, and we're going to cheat a little bit. We're going to speed Venus up just an imperceptible amount, and Venus, with its gravity, is going to slow us down and bend the spacecraft's orbit towards the sun. So just this November 1st, we'll have our first encounter with the sun. I said Earth is 215 solar radii away from the sun. We're going to get to 35 solar radii, about one-seventh of the distance back towards Earth. That'll already be closer than any human object has ever gotten. Over the course of the next 7 years, we have five more encounters with Venus, each time letting us get closer and closer. So by the end of the mission, we're less than 10 solar radii, or about 4% of the distance above the sun. And those will be our closest approaches.
So this idea that we're going to touch the sun is almost as good as.
Yeah. Well, so what does that actually mean as a scientist? There's a special type of wave in the solar atmosphere called an Alfvén wave. It's a magnetic wave, and they move really fast, so even faster than a sound wave. We think, we don't know exactly where this is, but we think 10, 20 solar radii above the sun's atmosphere, the wind is now moving faster than even these Alfvén waves. And that's where we think you make the transition between a solar atmosphere that's rotating with the sun and it's in communication with the sun and this kind of detached solar wind. So if we can get below that so-called Alfvén point, we can actually see the solar atmosphere for the first time. So that's what we mean when we say touching the sun. We want to get in there and scoop up samples of the solar atmosphere.
Now, I know you're a principal investigator for the instruments on the probe, observing the ions and electrons.
Yes, that's right.
Taking the samples to make up the solar wind and atmosphere. And I understand you think of one of these instruments, the solar probe cup, as the bravest little instrument.
Yes, that's right. Well, so the beautiful thing about this spacecraft for most of the instruments is we have this amazing state-of-the-art heat shield. It's about 10 square meters. It's made of a foam of carbon. I mean, if you looked at it, it kind of looks like shaving cream foam or something like that. It's almost translucent up close. But it's made of carbon, and it can withstand temperatures of like 3,000 degrees. The front of that's at 1,500 degrees Celsius, but the back, which is only like tens of centimeters thick, the back is only at a couple hundred degrees. And so instead of seeing this intense sun that would vaporize almost any normal material, all the instruments in the shadow, they'll see amount of heat equivalent to the light bulb in a refrigerator. So barely any heat at all. So they've got a wonderful journey ahead of them. They'll get really nice, strong signals, but they'll be in an environment that's very similar to if you were on a spacecraft orbiting Earth. But the solar probe cup, unfortunately, if we want to see the solar wind, which generally flows away from the sun, we need an instrument that looks straight at the sun. And we can't have a heat shield just covering the whole front because the wind has to flow into the instrument. So what we have to do with the cup is actually use refractory metals and artificial crystals that we grow, very special materials that can withstand these extreme temperatures and let us actually see the wind and collect samples of the wind in the atmosphere and read out things like how fast is it flowing, which way is it headed, you know, is it flapping around or not, or is it steady? Basic observations like that.
You're kind of blowing my mind as you describe all of these things. And I know you're a scientist, but do you find yourself thinking that this is the stuff of mythology?
I know. You know, you sometimes – well, first of all, you sometimes sit there going, you know, okay, we're going to touch the sun. Like, doesn't mythology suggest we shouldn't be going there? Hasn't this gone poorly for other people
in
the past?
Didn't go well for Icarus.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's definitely an historic well, I don't want to say accomplishment yet. We've launched, and so far things are going well, knock on wood. But I think it will be a very historic moment to send a spacecraft to a star for the first time.
What does this mean for mankind?
Well, at a minimum, I hope that it's going to significantly improve our understanding of our star and other stars. So, you know, understand what's responsible for these really high temperatures in our solar atmosphere. And then in terms of knowledge for mankind and benefits, I think of it in two directions. One, space and the solar atmosphere, it's like our little nearby laboratory where we get to see hands-on what plasmas are like in the rest of the universe. So, you know, material falling into black holes, the material spinning around a young star as new planets are being formed for the first time. These are all plasmas that are very difficult to recreate in the lab. So if we can go there and understand, you know, how the magnetic field is involved in heating, how different structures form, that's going to inform our understanding of a lot of other astrophysical objects. And then if you look on Earth, you know, I mean, I'll just pick one example, and who knows if this will work out, mm-hmm. but, you know, controlled fusion is potentially like the way in the future for the ultimate clean energy source. And what we struggle with is how do you get the plasma in a fusion reactor really hot, and how do you confine it? There are these instabilities that rip it apart. We don't understand how to heat it very reliably. My hope is one day we'll take what we learn with probe, and maybe we can apply that to things like fusion power.
What happens to the probe at the end of the 7 years?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So there are a lot of things we're really worried about. We're going to unexplored territory. So, of course, we always worry there's something, you know, that we're unaware of, right? But there are a couple things that we know are going to be a problem. I mentioned before that the sun is about 500 times brighter. That means the light is so intense that at closest approach, the pressure from the photons from the sun itself is so intense, it would flip the spacecraft around in under a minute if we weren't actually actively pushing back. So we have these big wheels in the center of the spacecraft. And as we get close to the sun and the light pushes on us, we spin the wheels faster and faster to push back. Now, you might imagine there's a motor in there. The wheels can only spin so fast. So every now and then we turn on, the spacecraft actually decides on itself when to do this. It turns on a rocket, fires the rocket, and while the rocket's on, it slows the wheel back down to zero. Now, we think we have a lot of fuel on the spacecraft, but at some point, and I hope it's much longer than the 7-year primary mission, at some point we're going to run out of fuel. We won't be able to spin down that wheel, and the sunlight's going to flip us around, and the sides of the spacecraft could only survive for seconds before they'd be vaporized. So then, for the next billion years, the heat shield and our solar probe cup and a couple other high-temperature instruments will basically just be in this weird elliptical orbit around the sun until bad news is about a billion years from now, the sun is going to expand and swallow up a solar probe in the Earth. But until then, we'll have this nice little relic of our mission.
And you and I will not be around to worry about
that. That's right. Not our problem.
Justin Kasper, a principal investigator for the Parker Solar Probe and a climate space science professor at the University of Michigan. Fascinating, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.